And now for introductions. Dr. Kim Maurer joined the OHSU Department of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine in 2006 after completing both a pain fellowship and pain research fellowship at Stanford University. She's the medical director of the Comprehensive Pain Management Center and vice chairperson of pain management at OHSU. Her publications include work on guidelines for pain management and work on opioid management. Dr. Maurer is certified in both pain medicine and anesthesiology and also works in inpatient pain management. She is a skilled and eager teacher, and we are so delighted to have Dr. Maurer join us today. Thanks.
Thank you, Laura. I want to thank you all very much for having me. I am not very good with technology, so thank goodness I have Laura to field the chat there. And I have my screen set up. I'm on a laptop in our procedure room, so I cannot see myself or see you, all of you. So if I get out of camera or I'm off tone here, someone just let me know. But we're going to kind of go through, I'm planning on doing about 45 minutes of talk, and then we'll have about 15 minutes for questions. And of course, you can always call myself or email me at the end if there's any questions that I didn't cover or things I said confusing or incorrect or anything like that. But thanks again for having me. The title today is Persistent Pain and Recent Updates. So we're going to talk a little bit about persistent pain and kind of what to do in situations of very chronic pain and just all the different theories out there, new tips and tricks, and we're also going to go over some kind of recent updates on things. So a little bit of a whirlwind through pain. So let me see if I can figure out how to advance my slide. Hold on. There we go. Okay. Disclosure, I have no disclosures. And so we will start with the numbers. So if you look at this picture, this came out of a JAMA article in 2019. So we're now about 5 years old on this data. But the reason I put this up is to kind of give a little bit of a perspective on how much pain is out there. So we know since 2019, the number has grown, has not got smaller. But in 2019, when JAMA put together this article, we were spending about $560 billion to $635 billion per year in the US. And that's a really high number on a medical treatment or on one type of a disease process of chronic pain. That was compared at that time to the outpatient spending in diabetes management and heart disease, and outpatient and inpatient spending of pain together combined was more than the combination of outpatient cardiac and diabetic management. So it's a huge number. We now know that about 100 million American individuals anywhere in the world at any one time will experience pain. And in a year, about one third of all people will have some kind of a pain incidence of Americans. We are much higher with those numbers for both acute and chronic pain than the rest of the world. And the population in 2020 was approximately 300 million Americans in the world, not all living in America, but total. And so 100 is approximately a third. So it's a big problem. Low back pain and headache are always battle every year for number one, and number two is kind of the top most reasons people miss work. So it's definitely something we need to pay a big attention to, not just because of its effect on our economy and industry, but also because of our quality of life. That's probably the most important, is it really affects people's quality of life. Now, there's four A's, and I like to start talks with the four A's. And what are the four A's? So I can't take credit for the four A's, really, because the four A's came from Dr. Pasek, works down in Southern California. But when you look at all your guidelines that are out there, when you're reading and you're treating care patients and you've got the CDC and the DEA and the FDA and all of these different organizations, and you just don't know that you're documenting appropriately, you're keeping your patients safe, you're doing all the right things, we always say fall back on your four A's. And I'm going to teach you the four A's today if you haven't learned these. If you follow the four A's, you will meet all the requirements that you need for the Oregon Medical Board, state licensing, county requirements, CDC requirements, DEA requirements. This will kind of cover everything. So the four A's, there's two good A's and two bad A's. So the good A's are, one of them is analgesia. So you need to show, and this is especially when you're doing things around opioid or controlled substances, such as ketamine, the benzodiazepines, testosterone, anything that has a controlled labeling, that the patient is receiving analgesia. Of course, if it's an analgesic medication. So does the patient have effective pain relief? That is one of your good A's. Then you don't want one of the bad A's, which is adverse effects. So, you know, is the patient having severe limiting adverse effects, or are they controlled? If it's an adverse effect, non-dangerous to life, and it's controlled, it's probably okay. Next good A, activity. Do they have increased function? And here I put with opioids, because that's especially one you need to look at these days around opioids, is that there's increased function. And are they meeting their activity goals? And then the last one is aberrant behavior, or sometimes we say adverse behavior to match the adverse effects. But, you know, are you screening them? Are you following all your screening protocols? And are you monitoring things? And aberrant behavior would refer to, you know, too much use of the ED, illicit use of medications, selling medications, obtaining illegally, things like that. So if you have the two good A's and the two bad A's, all under control, and you're documenting the four A's, you're pretty much covered by any guideline, recommendation, anything that we're supposed to do to be good providers. So those are your four A's. Again, I can't get credit for it, but it's kind of a smart thing, the four A's. Now, if you're not getting the right answer on your four A's, it probably means that it's time to change some of your chronic pain management. It doesn't mean you have to be getting the four A's on every therapy, but especially if you have one therapy out there that's kind of, you know, getting two or only one of these correct, it's probably time to try to change gear. And especially if you're on the opioids, this is a time when we want to talk about starting to wean or take our patient down off of their opiate therapies. And Pasek had another saying I always loved in pain. I'm saying it like he's not here. He's still practicing, but you know, if you can't land the plane, don't take off the plane. So we always say if you can't get a patient off of opiates very easily, which it's not usually an easy task, we probably shouldn't start them on opiates, because landing that plane and taking away or reducing someone's opiates is always much harder than starting the opiates in the beginning. Now, I want to move into a little bit when we talk about chronic pain, the different types. And I did make this talk more about persistent pain, which is what we like to kind of call chronic pain these days, than about acute pain. But in the olden days, and I say olden loosely to mean, you know, early 90s, late 90s, before we made it to the 2000s, we kind of looked at chronic pain in five big categories: nociceptive, neuropathic, visceral, cancer, and somatic. And cancer pain was kind of given its own category, even though cancer pain can be a combination of nociceptive, neuropathic, visceral, or somatic. And often cancer pain is a mixture of all of those components. So those were kind of our five big categories. And then as we got into the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, we kind of decided that we needed to have a little bit better definition of neuropathic pain, because neuropathic pain really is only defined by its quality, the type of pain, or what we can see on imaging. Oh, look, the L5 nerve root is impinged by the L4, L5 foramen. So we didn't really have a good definition of neuropathic. So we've tried to kind of define down the types of chronic pain better now. So now what I would say we kind of do just broadly is three big categories. We kind of just don't really list cancer as a separate pain category anymore. And we say we've got a peripheral nociceptive, a peripheral neuropathic, and a centralized pain. And this centralized pain can be neuropathic or nociceptive, or just refer to it as centralized. And for a long time, that term was central sensitization. And you would hear that term a lot, especially around fibromyalgia and conditions that are a little bit more refractory to pain management or normal techniques. These are things like irritable bowel, restless leg syndrome, chronic migraine, hypermobility syndromes. But now we just kind of say they're centralized pain syndromes. And the reason we distinguish centralized from peripheral is we're really, really finding that they're different beasts. They're very different pain syndromes. So I would even argue as much today that centralized fibromyalgia is more different from a, well, fibromyalgia is a centralized condition, but just for the sake of example, a peripheral fibromyalgia or pain condition, then fibromyalgia is from restless legs. So my point to that, if I'm not making sense, is that centralized pain is really, no matter what type of pain condition becomes centralized, a chronic migraine, a fibromyalgia, a restless legs, a hypermobility syndrome, is really a very different package to take care of as opposed to your peripheral entities. Nociceptive, of course, is going to be anything that sets off nociceptors. In that picture, we have a man or a lady pushing on a thumbtack. That's going to be a nociceptive pain. And then, of course, peripheral neuropathic is anything in the peripheral neuropathic pain system, like diabetes, like an injury to a nerve, ulnar, median ulnar neuropathies, things like that. Centralized neuropathic pain is going to be more of your multiple sclerosis, your autoimmune disorders, Sjogren's, Raynaud's, things like that. So kind of think of it as two peripheral categories and one centralized. Now, when we look at the pathways of pain, this is really important, not so much for day-to-day, what we pick out of our drug cabinet to give to our patients, but really about where in the pain pathway are we needing to focus our medications and our targets. Because remember, we have medications that will target the thalamus, the somatosensory cortex, that we have things that will target out in the periphery in our pain-sensing nociceptors. So you kind of need to think about where on this pathway your pain signaling is occurring the most. All of it's going to be activated, but what part maybe in your patient is probably the most activated? Hard to know, but we think about transduction, modulation, transmission, and perception. And I put this up in every talk, especially to the medical students, because this is kind of a fun slide to go through these.
Dr. Maurer, I'm going to step in just a moment. I'm not sure your slides are not advancing. I'm not sure if they're advanced on your screen.
They are. Are they not advancing on yours?
Mystery of mysteries. Yes.
Okay.
A moment.
Maybe I shared wrong. I'm not always the best at doing these things.
I wonder.
Do you want me to come back to the Teams for a second and see if I can look at my buttons?
Yeah, maybe we'll just take a pause for a moment. Thanks while everybody hangs with us.
It says we are still sharing, but you guys can't see it. You want me to unshare and share again?
Let's try that. Thanks.
Okay. Is it on pathways?
It's just reloading a moment. There we go. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, we're back. Okay. So transduction is what happens, you know, in our periphery with our algesic substances. This is going to be anything from force, heat, cold, chemicals. We modulate things at our dorsal root ganglion. And the dorsal root ganglion is going to be at your entry level to your spinal cord. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these DRG stimulators. So you guys have probably heard of these peripheral nerve stimulators and DRG stimulators. These are all like little spinal cord stimulators we're trying to put in the DRG at the dorsal root ganglion to really modulate the pain signal. There's a lot of theory that we amp up our pain signals in our DRG area. Transmission is that pathway of modulation up to the spinal centers of our brain, up to our somatosensory cortex. That's going to be our nociceptors that are stimulated that carry the C and alpha A delta fiber pain, as well as sensitization starts to happen here. So sensitization happens as soon as that signal gets to the DRG. And then we have perception. Perception is, in my mind, this is the money slide, or this is the money piece. Perception is where we have those ascending excitatory pathways and the descending inhibitory pathways. These are called our spine pain pathways. And this is what Melzack and Wall wrote about in their gait control theory. So if you've heard of gait control theory, that is where we talk about how you can take a signal up And can your brain keep it from coming back down? Because if you modulate the signal in the somatosensory cortex, but you can't send the signal back down through the thalamic pathways, then you really can't have your finger hurt, right? After you've touched a hot stove. So we're really spending a lot of time right now on the modulation piece and the perception piece in the brain. We can't really stop transmission. You know, once a signal gets transmitted up the spinal cord, it kind of starts, but we can modulate it different. And modulation is really all about, you know, when it gets to the thalamus, which is like Grand Central Station of New York City, like where do all these trains go? Like, how do we keep it from spreading to the whole brain and especially to the somatosensory cortex, which is what kind of gives that signal meaning. So it's just an important slide to kind of keep in mind when you're thinking about what's happening beneath the skin in your patients. I'm going to advance. If you guys can't see it, just someone holler at me. Okay. So acute versus chronic, when is it persistent pain? It's a good question. We generally define it as 12 weeks. I will say that the time frame is coming down. You can't see it again, Laura?
We can't see it again. Ugh. I'm so sorry, Dr. Maurer. Let's see. Tech input.
Let me try, you know, I'm going to stop sharing. I can share my window, but I don't know what that does. Is that showing it?
No.
How about there?
There we go. Okay.
Okay, we're back up and running. Here we go. Okay. So acute pain is really a somatosensory stimuli, mechanical or inflammatory, usually. It can be heat or something else, and a peripheral injury or lesion that's identifiable. Chronic or persistent pain is when we assume that the offending injury or lesion is healed, but we're still having pain symptoms. And then both acute and chronic in the olden days were non-cancer and not rapidly progressive, right? These were cancers, or non-cancer pains. Now I would say that you don't need to call cancer pain separate, and you could have cancer pain be acute or cancer pain be chronic. And we do use the term persistent pain because I think it just sounds a little nicer, right? Too, it is a little bit more hopeful than saying chronic, you have chronic pain, we're never going to make it better, to say it's kind of persistent, like it's hanging out and it's there all the time, but we're still going to try to get it better for you. Okay, hopefully you guys can see this. We're on a little slide with a few little nerves. Some concepts that are kind of important to remember in both persistent and acute pain, but probably even more persistent, is remember the pain in 99.9% of the cases is just your physiology gone awry. It is not actually a lesion, a cut nerve, a torn tissue, a damaged retina, bleeding somewhere. It's usually just the physiology is on this negative feedback loop and it's just spinning itself. It's spinning on itself. I like to say that it's like a radio when you're fine tuning. I mean, I don't even know how many of us really turn on the radio anymore, but maybe we do. The radio, when you're fine tuning a station and you're like between 98.9 and 98.8 and it's kind of fuzzy and you haven't fine tuned it, that's physiology gone awry. It's like that fuzzy radio station and that's what's causing the pain. Most nerve damage. When you get a nerve cut by a surgeon, when you damage a nerve on an injury, it does not lead to ongoing pain. So even though I presented those slides that a third of people will have chronic pain or some type of pain every year, most people still, two-thirds, do not heal and lead to ongoing pain. And the severity, we know this so well from studies now, so well, that the severity of the damage does not correlate to the severity of the pain. We know that on x-rays, we know that on MRIs, we know that on CTs, we know that on nerve conduction studies, we know that on looking at the nerve under a microscope. So pain does not correlate well to how a system or a tissue or a cell looks. And the really hard thing about chronic pain, I always say, or persistent pain, is there's no really good test to tell us if someone has pain or how bad it is. For example, if you guys are diagnosing hypertension and your patient comes in at 220 over 180, takes some meds, comes back, they're 180 over 150, we can all see they've gotten better. But I don't have a way to do that in my patients. I don't have an objective way to measure how much better their pain has gotten. And I don't know if you can see my hands now because I can't see the camera, but if this is someone's full spectrum of pain, and I work really, really hard with them, and I can see that in their life now, their pain's only this, it's a much smaller space. This is what your brain now sees as your 10 out of 10. So pain is so subjective that you're always resetting your 10 out of 10, and it makes it hard to tell if you're getting better. Your entire nervous system can be involved. And as you guys know, pain can change everything in a person's life. I think that's the hardest part. It's the not the actual sensation of something that's uncomfortable, but it's the suffering that comes with it. And why does inflammation hurt? Simple. Inflammation is swelling. We build up fluid. These swollen tissues then push against these nerve endings, which have kind of become very sensitized by the fluid and the inflammatory milieu they're sitting in. We get prostaglandin release. Prostaglandin release kind of sets off an inflammatory cycle. And when nerves are bathed in an inflammatory medium or milieu, they don't like it. And they say, what's this fluid weighing me down? What's all this prostaglandins around me? And they change their firing processes. And it's when nerves fire at a different rate and pattern than their normal firing that you carry pain signals. And remember, nerves carry all kinds of signals, right? We have itching, we have dolorosa, we have anesthesia, we have analgesia, we have allodynia, we have hyperalgesia, we have hypoalgesia. So all of these different firing processes changing gives us different symptoms. And really, when you look at what we're trying to do now, it really is about the prostaglandin. I mean, we are really trying to lower inflammation. When you lower inflammation, you lower your prostaglandin release. The less prostaglandin release, the less acidity you release. And the overall lower pH and lower inflammation tends to keep pain levels lower. And we have some pretty good studies starting to develop on that front, that in all conditions, persistent pain or acute pain, these lower inflammatory levels are some of the more helpful things we can do to promote healing, to promote pain coming down, and to let our medications work better. So you're going to see a lot out there about lowering inflammation and pain. If you haven't already, you know, the low histamine diet, people alkalize their water, they eat low acidity foods. I mean, a lot of these things to lower inflammation. A lot of the stuff we are doing to lower inflammation hasn't been proven, but the concept is starting to look pretty good. Now I'm going to bring a little bit about low-dose naltrexone in here because it really fits into our inflammatory piece. Low-dose naltrexone is old. It's as old as dirt. It's been around since 1984. And in the olden days, we used it, our psychiatrists used it a lot for obsessive compulsive disorder. They still use it some. And it was used in high doses, 50 to 300 milligrams per day. And it was really good for those intrusive, repeating obsessive thoughts. And then we started playing with it a little bit, even though it only comes in a 50 milligram tablet as its smallest dose. And we started looking at smaller doses like 4.5 and 2.5 milligrams per day. And we found that when you have these smaller doses, you actually do something for inflammation. I'm going to show you in this little teeter-totter, which hopefully you can see, but you balance your mu and your delta opioid receptors. So the mu receptors are kind of constantly stimulated. These are our natural endorphins, our enkephalins, our dynorphins, our dystrophins. They're naturally bound to our mu receptors. So this is runner's high, the first sip of hot coffee in the morning, a bite of chocolate, you know, the feel-good sensation at the end of a movie. These are your natural endorphins. And we live in a state where, again, you may not be able to see my hands, where our mu are more heavily weighted and bound than our delta opioid receptors. And we found now that if we can get this teeter-totter into balance and balance our mu and delta, meaning unbind a little bit of our mu and bind a little more of our delta or trigger a little more of our delta receptors, that we can kind of chronically lower inflammation. And low-dose naltrexone is really good about doing that, because what low-dose naltrexone does is it comes in a tiny amount and just blocks a small amount of your mu receptors so that they're blocked instead of an overwhelming large amount blocked by our dynorphins or enkephalins, endogenous or exogenous opioids we're taking. We'd like this little bit of low-dose naltrexone kind of keeps us humming along and allows our delta to come down into balance with the mu, which balance out inflammation. In balancing the mu and the delta, you kind of balance that glial cell activation level in your CSF fluid, and your CSF fluid with high microglial activation is also very inflammatory. So low dose naltrexone, by balancing mu and delta and kind of keeping the glial cells from activating as much in the CSF, is one way we can lower inflammation. And that's why we use so much low dose naltrexone in these very inflammatory, long-term persistent pain indices and diagnoses, such as fibromyalgia, chronic migraine, hypermobility, irritable bowel, right? These patients probably live with even more inflammation than others. And so we use a lot of low dose naltrexone, for example, in fibromyalgia. And then buprenorphine. We have brought in buprenorphine because on that same concept, if you're blocking a little bit of the mu, so they've got like competitive inhibitory response in there so that you can't put as much agonistic response on, you can bring delta into balance with those mu receptors. It's really about balancing out some of these opioid receptors. Buprenorphine is great. And as you all know, we are now using it for chronic pain, persistent pain, acute pain. And in our clinic, I don't know if you guys are doing this, not saying it's right or not, but what we do, we are taking buprenorphine and taking our patients who are on Vicodin and methadone and fentanyl patches and moving them to buprenorphine. Now, we're not moving people who are on low dose and very stable and doing great. We're leaving them on their current opiates. But if someone's struggling with their opiate therapies and we don't think they're going to get off, we're moving them to buprenorphine, even if it's not OUD or some type of side effect from respiratory depression on their opiates. We're just kind of using buprenorphine. And new patients that need opiate therapies, we are starting with buprenorphine. We've even moved our cancer population over to buprenorphine. And a little bit of its timeline, just to let you know, I said naltrexone was older than DIRT, but look at buprenorphine. So buprenorphine actually came out in 1966. It was invented. It started getting used in the UK first in 1978, and it was IV. I mean, they're always ahead of us. They have everything IV and fancy before we get it. But they had IV buprenorphine back in 1978. In 1981 is when we first brought it kind of across the pond over here, and we said, hey, we're going to make an injectable buprenorphine. That was Buprenex, and that was a Schedule II opioid. And then in 2002, between those years of 81 and 2002, we did a lot of research to learn that it was a mixed agonist-antagonist, probably a little bit safer, and buprenorphine was kept as a opioid but moved down and less regulated to a Schedule III. And that's when we came out with Suboxone, which of course has naloxone with buprenorphine. And we came out with sublingual buprenorphine Subutex. And then comes along in 2010, you know, 2002 to 2010, we were in the height of the opioid epidemic, right? Biggest year, probably 2008, somewhere in there. And we said, oh my gosh, this buprenorphine is much better than methadone. We're not hurting as many people. We need something for chronic pain, because for a long time we were using buprenorphine only for opiate use disorder. And that's when the transdermal Butrans patch came out, because we didn't really have anything for long-standing persistent pain in the buprenorphine world. So we started using Butrans. And then in 2015, we kind of said we need something a little longer acting. And so that's when we came out with Belbuca, which is a longer acting chronic or more persistent pain Belbuca buprenorphine treatment. However, now we just kind of use all of them for all the pains, the cancer pains, the acute pains, the persistent pain. We really don't differentiate Butrans patches from Belbuca, from Suboxone, from Subutex. Now, ketamine. Now, ketamine has come into the world. Ketamine also around for a long time, 1960s. It was used in the OR. I mean, as an anesthesiologist, I'm not quite that old, so I didn't get to use ketamine then, but it was used in general ORs as an anesthetic agent in the 60s. And we still do use it some on the pediatric side, and we use it in adult anesthetic cases for really refractory pain. And then it kind of moved out of the OR and it moved into the OR's ICUs, and we kind of started just using it for sedation and lighter anesthesia cases. And then it kind of got picked up now in emergency departments and out in the field by EMS. And now we've got it picked up for depression, and we're starting to see it for PTSD, generalized anxiety disorder, long COVID symptoms. And the thing about ketamine, there is good and bad, as there are with many things in life. The good of ketamine is it does kind of reset those spinal thalamic pathways, and it works as being an antagonist at our NMDA receptor. The bad of ketamine is it's really starting to get abused and misused out in the population. I mean, it has a nickname of Special K among high schoolers and college kids. And it's starting to ramp up in its use before we really know how to use it appropriately in an outpatient world. And so that's kind of my negative side. Uh-oh, no slide.
For whatever reason, we haven't advanced. Maybe if you unshare and share, we'll just keep
okay, let's unshare along. And share. Okay, let me share again. Am I back?
Just taking a second to load.
Oh, perfect. I'll take a sip of juice.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. We're back. So we now for pain management, I will tell you what we're doing here at OHSU. Not that this is, oh, not there.
You don't see the slides.
Okay, let me try again. Stop sharing and share. Not back?
No, I wonder if we're just having trouble with connection transmission. Apologies to you, Dr. Maurer, and our audience. We will be sure to send the slides after the talk.
Oh, yes. We'll make sure and give them to you guys. Okay, let me try again. We ran through it yesterday and everything was fine, so I don't know what happens today. Of course, because that is life, right? I have four kids. I'm totally used to this kind of stuff. Okay, I'm trying again. It says I'm sharing, but
tech folks have any thoughts for us?
I don't know. Can I give you control or something? Would that do it?
Well,
I don't know if there's a way to do that. I can do stop presenting again. I'm so sorry, you guys.
No, it's okay. I might leave myself one moment and come back in case it's a problem on my end.
I don't have a button.
Wonder if there's a possible way to email, see if we want to, I don't know if it's easy to send your slides to Stephanie Munoz and she could direct them from her end.
Yes, I can try that. Let me see. I can also try, do you want me to try reloading them here or something?
Yeah.
Okay, can you see now? I'm just going back from the beginning, like reloading them. You guys can't see the screen moving. Okay, well, okay, let me try emailing them. I can always come back to another date or email them to you guys.
Oh, for sure. Let me just give it a moment. No rush.
Okay, let me send him to Stephanie and see if she can drive for us. See, I'm holding up my end of the bargain that I'm really bad at technology.
I think not, Dr. Maurer. Challenges with tech at times.
Yes. Okay, Stephanie, these came your way if you're on. Let her drive.
Dr. Maurer, while Stephanie is working to get those pulled up, in your experience for logistics of prescribing low dose naltrexone, given it only comes in the 50 milligram tablets, any quick tips while we're working on slides?
Yes, there is a couple of tips I can tell you. So one, we do it as a compounded agent through Lloyd Center Pharmacy or Beaverton Pharmacy. Those seem to be kind of some of the better prices. There's also a compounding pharmacy in Lake Oswego we use, Central Compounding Pharmacy. And you want to write it as a 5, 4.5, or 2 milligram dosing. There is a recipe circulating out there for how patients could make their own with a 50 milligram tablet. We're not allowed to do it at OHSU, but you can dissolve the tablet in water and then, you know, like take little bits of water. But, you know, there's no good really data that I've seen about how well that works. So we do it as a compounded medication. With a good RX coupon, we can usually get it to about $60 a month for our patients. Through Lloyd, Beaverton, they're all about the same price, and just write it as a compounded solution or compounded medication. I will tell you at the federal level, they are looking at trying to make some smaller doses, naltrexone, I mean low dose, which would be nice if we had smaller tablets.
Exciting. That's great. Thank you. Yeah. I'm not familiar with using GoodRx on a compounded agent, but
yeah.
You just do
yeah.
it.
You just write it. So what you write on your prescription is you write, take 1 5 milligram dose per day, or take 1 4.5 milligram dose per day. It works best once a day, or take 1 2 milligram. You know, you can go as low as one. Less than one, I think, is too low, and more than five kind of loses that low dose effect. And you just write that on the prescription, and then write the number of days you want, 30 days with the refills, and then just have them take it to any pharmacy that does compounding. And when you do compounding medications, you don't even have to write compounding on there because they'll know it needs to be compounded. You don't have to write like make it from a 50. They know all that. So you can just kind of write the dose you want.
Great.
You can send it electronically because naltrexone is non-controlled. In a sense, it's not controlled like the opiate agonists are controlled.
Great. I see Stephanie working with your slides, so I think we're awfully close.
Oh, yay. Good. Thank you, Stephanie. I'm sure you can drive all this much better than I can. Yeah, but we do a lot of low-dose naltrexone. The nice thing about low-dose naltrexone, while we're just talking, is it only has a 6-hour half-life. So unlike buprenorphine, when people are on buprenorphine and then they come into the hospital, right, and you need to give them opiates, you're like, oh gosh, that buprenorphine is going to be there for like 5 days, right, 72 hours. Low-dose naltrexone is pretty much gone in 6 hours, even if you've been on a continuous dose. So, you know, if they come in a car accident, you can pretty quickly get them opiate agonist. Oh, look, we have slides. Okay. I don't know if I can advance. Probably Stephanie has to drive, right?
Yeah, sorry, I think Stephanie will just listen to your cue and
I
be able to advance.
I just need to know which slide you're on.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Stephanie, can you go to the ketamine one?
I think farther.
It has like a little stop sign. It's probably like, I think there's 25 slides and it's like 20.
Stephanie, you were there several slides ago. There we go. Perfect.
Uh-oh, you're not going to like this. No, I can't see them. Well, wait, I can do them on my laptop, I guess. Let me see. Can I pull them up on the side and just minimize you guys? So,
yes, that'll work.
Okay. Because I can't see them on the screen. Okay, so I'm going to just do them off my screen here to me. Okay, so on ketamine, I'll tell you when I'm advancing on my end, Stephanie. You know, for acute pain, it's very good in the hospital. For chronic pain, really only the literature is kind of starting to show depression, long COVID, PTSD, CRPS. We don't have, and this is an important point, we don't have good data to say if you're using it for persistent pain, how often, how much, and how long. And so we're not doing it here at OHSU yet until we feel like there's a little better data about like, okay, they need 100 milligrams every 2 hours for 2 days in a row, and then a week off, and then start it again. Like, we don't have that kind of data to know. So I know a lot of people are doing IV ketamine clinics, and it probably is doing something, but we just don't know how long the relief is. what to charge for that. It's not covered by insurance. How long to run it? Are there long-term toxic effects? At what dose? So I will just say, be careful. I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing it outpatient, but we've kind of chosen to wait till the data gets a little better for outpatient kind of ketamine use. Okay, Stephanie, I'm going to my CDC guidelines slide. So I can't see you guys anymore because I had to pull up my slide separate. So just someone holler at me if you need me. So the CDC guidelines 2022, basically I have a slide here if you can see it that says remove the line in the sand. And the idea behind this was that we kind of put a line in the sand a little bit, not meaning to, I think, with the 2016 guidelines and the 2018 kind of work around opioids, that people felt like they could only be at 90, they could only be at 60, they had to be at 120 morphine equivalents. And now I think what we're kind of saying is you decide, you look at your patient, and if you've got a patient on a reasonable dose, you know, 100 morphine, 90 morphine a day, they're doing well, there really isn't a number you need to come down to. And there really isn't a top number you shouldn't go over. Just kind of stay in the middle lane, stay in the gray zone, and it's up to you. We're trying to take away any lines of true morphine analogy doses that we need to stop. And fentanyl, I'm going to go over a little bit about fentanyl, and then let's see how many slides we have. We have about 10 left. I'm going to go up kind of quickly to the last 10, so I do leave about 10 minutes for questions, but then I will always be able to email, talk on the phone to you, and we'll send these out. For fentanyl, just remember that fentanyl has now kind of become our new drug of choice for abuse and misuse. And the couple of things that always happen once drugs get on the street, just so we're aware as prescribers to be responsible, things that are going to tend to get misused are things with a rapid onset, a brief duration of action, high lipophilicity, things that can be made soluble or vaporized, and that people, quote, feel at work. And heroin is kind of the prototypical drug for that. I mean, heroin characterizes all those things very well. We've moved from heroin to fentanyl because fentanyl is very much, it's a rapid onset, it's got a brief duration, so they feel a high and then it's over. It's very easy to get into their system because of its lipophilicity. It has lots of ways they can administer it. So just to think about that when we're prescribing things, about why things we use in the medical world become used illegally or illicitly. And why do we taper opioids? I will really wanted you to see this because we are, you know, we were tapering a lot in the years of like 2018 to about 2020, 21. Now we're slowing down the tapering. Why do we taper? I just wanted to give you some data behind this. 50% of the time that we were tapering, when we were tapering heavily, was after the first set, the previous CDC guidelines that kind of gave some of those morphine equivalent suggestions. That was 50% of the reason why people were tapering opioids. Then at 32% was misuse. We felt that there was about 32% of the time patients were not safely using their medications. And then the last thing was regulations, 29%. And I put this slide up here to show you that regulations are now almost caught up to misuse and will probably surpass. So I don't know if you've noticed it in your practice, but I have an increasingly high amount of situations where the electronic prescribing is down. A pharmacy system has been hacked, like recently. Insurances just aren't covering. We have a national shortage, a worldwide shortage of Vicodin, a shortage of oxycodone. We don't make 15s anymore. We only make 10s. And I think you're going to see more of that happening. So I think you're going to see that access is going to become harder and harder, and it's probably going to be a little bit more about access issues now than us feeling like we need to taper because we're uncomfortable. The X waiver, this is a quick slide. You all know the X waiver is now kind of gone. So you can prescribe buprenorphine, which is your standard DEA, and you can use it for pain. You can use it when you suspect disuse, misuse. That's talking about buprenorphine without an X waiver. Gabapentin, I'm not going to go into a lot of gabapentin, age-old drug, lots and lots and lots of studies on it. I mean, we use gabapentin like it's kind of in the water around here. It is a subtle agent, but it is a good one, and it does work well. It does have things you have to watch out for, and we can do a talk about gabapentin at some point, but a very good medication. And then pregabalin, a lot of people always ask, how do you really dose pregabalin? Most of us know how to dose gabapentin, you know, multiple times a day. It has low bioavailability, so you have to take a lot of it very often. You know, when they were designing gabapentin in the trials, they actually designed it best, and it worked best, at a tablet every hour. Like if you took gabapentin 24 times a day, one every hour of the day. But that's not feasible for patient practicality. So, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons pregabalin came out, because it has better bioavailability and a little bit more power for each punch. So when we do pregabalin, we tend to initiate it about 75 milligrams at bedtime. And then in 3 to 7 days, we'll increase up to about 75 twice a day. And then we'll adjust every week. Maximum is 600. We use higher doses at night to facilitate sleep. And remember that there are no studies of pregabalin going higher than 600. So that is the top dose. And there really aren't good studies on mixing pregabalin and gabapentin. So you don't want that much of calcium channel modulation. So remember, these are calcium channel modulators, not blockers. So we really do only want to be on gabapentin or pregabalin, not both at the same time. And with opiates now, I would say we're really kind of moving away from long acting. I wouldn't say you can't do them, but I would say the trend is really kind of towards short acting and more limited. At least, you know, what I see in my world here, I'm not saying I'm the expert by any means in what the trend is with opiates, but and what we see in our hospital setting, we're doing a lot more short acting so people can try to get their doses down and use them in a more limited fashion than the long acting, which are harder to wean, harder to taper, hard to adjust a dose on. And again, buprenorphine is kind of becoming the go-to opioid for almost everything. Few things about opiates in women. There's a lot of literature looking at how women are different with persistent pain, especially around opioids. These are all things that happen with and around women in clinics. Women and a man, like a woman and a man, these are really some fascinating studies, will go into a clinic with the same condition. And it didn't matter if the provider was female or male, the female patient will end up getting more opioids when they leave than the male. We also write higher doses to women. Women have more of the conditions that probably don't respond well to opiates, fibromyalgia, migraines. That may be because women tend to seek out medical care more than men, so maybe they get diagnosed more. We know infertility risks are increased with long-term opiate therapy, amenorrhea. We know there are some studies around birth defects and risk of opiates in pregnancy. You guys know that way more than I do being in medicine. Polypharmacy tends to be more common in women. They're more likely to have more meds in their medicine cabinet and taking other medications with their opioids. And this is kind of sad, but true, that if you've had misuse and you're in recovery and you're doing well, women are more likely to fall back into that pattern of, I should really have misuse or disuse than abuse on there than men. Once you restart a prescription opiate, they're going to fall back into some of those older habits. Women also more likely to have anxiety and depression, both which opiates are not great for. And women in the hospital, if you give two patients, women and a man, the same type of surgery, same background, women will more likely be at risk for chronic pain after a surgery than men. And women use prescription opioid pain medications for longer periods at higher doses. And 65% of prescriptions that go out of hospitals go to women, with about 35% going to men. And 40% more women than men become persistent opioid users following standard surgeries at a hospital than men. So just not to say we're not going to do anything differently than we're doing. We're still going to prescribe no matter if you're female, male. But just to know the women are a little bit more at risk for some of the bad things that can happen on opiates. Quick slide here on CBD. CBD is still being looked at. It's the CB1 and the CB2 receptors. They are starting to show a lot of evidence for chronic arthritic and musculoskeletal pain at the CB2 binding site. Those are our endocannabinoid binding sites. These are CB2 agonists. So we'll see if we get a prescription CB2 drug. We now have them for children and seizures, but we don't have any for chronic pain that are prescription. And then just a few things on procedures. You know, your patients now can do a lot of stuff for osteoarthritis. We can burn any more in pain, almost any sensory nerve that carries C and A delta fiber pain. This is just a picture of the knee and the geniculate nerves we burn around the knee. We do this for the hip. We do this for the shoulder. Once they get the technology down, we'll probably have it for the ankle. Those are just smaller nerves, so it's taking a little bit longer to kind of delineate out where all those nerve patterns run. Talk about facets and facet joint pain. This is your osteoarthritic or facet arthropathy. You'll hear people get denervations or rhizotomy or medial branch denervations, facet zygotomy procedures for this. And then we have complements of Cool Leaf. This is a company. We are now moving into when we do these heat generated lesioning of any sensory nerve that causes pain around the knee, and shoulder arthritis, around the back, the cervical spine. We're doing a heat and cool lesion together, which is called Cool Leaf. And you can look in that picture of a standard RF needle, and that's a needle with a little red dot that shows heat. And then that little red dot next to that little yellow circle on the picture on the left, if you all can see this. Oh, I'm forgetting to tell Stephanie to move. Ah. Stephanie, I'm so sorry. I just kind of started flying through slides.
That's okay. I'm keeping up.
Oh, you're the best. I can't see you guys, so I didn't know you're keeping up. I'm so sorry about that. That little red is where the heat extends out from that heated needle tip to burn all that nerve. And that little red dot on that brown, looks like a piece of hair, is supposed to be a nerve. And then you look at the cooled RF, and that's our new lesioning probe down on that brown chocolate swab there, whatever you want to call that. Is supposed to be a nerve. That shows you how you get bigger heat and cold. The heat is the orange, the cold is the purple radiating out. And we found when we do that, we get pretty good relief for 6 months to a year before the myelin sheath kind of regenerates itself on these nerves. So we can't do this on motor nerves because you'll lose motor function, but we do them on sensory nerves. And then the nerve kind of dies back through a process of a Wallerian degeneration. And this is becoming very, very popular therapy for all the osteoarthritic pain we're seeing as people age and as people don't want to need to be on a lot of medications for pain. And I think this last one, Stephanie, you can advance, is my email, which you can call me at any time. And I will see if I can stop sharing, or maybe I'm not sharing anymore. I guess I'm not. So we can do questions. Sorry, that was a little bit of a tornado at the end.
Wonderful. Right? Just practice and patience and problem solving, which is perfect for persistent pain. So thank you, Dr. Bauer. We do have a few questions from the audience that we'll go ahead and get to.
Perfect.
Yeah. Some mention for, have you had any concerns or protocols with regard to that buprenorphine may prolong the QT?
Yes, and I thank you very much, whoever wrote that question. I forgot to put, I need to put a slide in. Buprenorphine does prolong QT. Not as much as some of the serotonin drugs, as like Zofran can and methadone, but it definitely can. So please watch for that. We do still do an EKG when we start buprenorphine and watch for that. I don't really have a heart, we don't have a really good protocol yet at what level of a QT interval prolongation we would stop the medication. It is still case by case. We are trying to come up with a protocol. Happy to share it with all of you if we get one. Yeah, that's a really, whoever brought up that question, thank you so much, because that is a, that can happen with buprenorphine. And I've seen it.
Thank you. And then in using buprenorphine for persistent pain as opposed to opiate use disorder, have you run into much troubles with costs and prior authorizations? And if so, any tips or tricks there?
Yes, you will get a little more stuck than when you're using it for use disorder. And I haven't had one go through yet. I just write a really nice note or do a phone call and just say, like, look, this is a safer opioid and they're going to be on an opiate. I'd rather have them on a partial agonist antagonist. And I haven't had any problems getting things through. I do know that the cost is supposed to continue to come down on buprenorphine. So that should keep making those things happen less where we get stuck.
Are you more commonly using a formulation like Suboxone now that we're not so much differentiating as opposed to the ones that are specifically FDA labeled for pain?
Yes. So here, we aren't. Here's what we do. We give Suboxone when it's used disorder. That's our go-to, right? And sometimes we don't use Suboxone if they prefer another type, but that's our go-to because it does have the naloxone in case there's a relapse or a problem. But then when we're just using it for chronic pain, we tend not to pick Suboxone as the first one, but give them any of the other ones. And I will say most people like the Subutex. Belbuca is really expensive, and most people don't like the patches. And personally, I don't really like the patches. I don't know. The patches kind of, I think, kind of remind me of the days of fentanyl patches. I don't know how easy they are to modulate the dose, right? So I use a lot of Belbuca, and I use a lot of just Subutex. But no specific one.
Great, thank you. Here's a comment with a paired question. I was able to wean a geriatric patient off of opioids after she started broad spectrum CBD without THC for generalized osteoarthritis. What are your thoughts on CBD versus opioids in terms of side effect profile, particularly in geriatrics?
Oh my gosh, that is such a wonderful question. If we had a great answer for that. Same thing around here. We have a lot of patients taking CBD, and I would say I'm not surprised it works because the literature is really showing that it binds that CB2 endocannabinoid receptor, and it's very good for osteoarthritic kind of musculoskeletal pain. Now, the data is still not great, in meaning that we don't have large quantity studies, but the small studies look pretty good. So as far as side effect profile, probably the CBD is a little better for them, but it's hard to say. I would just weigh the risk of each individual patient. What I will say is I try not to have people combine them, because I think when they combine opiates with CBD, they start to get, those two don't mix well together. They just don't. And so I think in elderly, maybe the CBD is a little less constipating, sedating, cognitive function affecting. But there's really no right or wrong there. And I haven't seen any guidance come out, and it could be missing it, but I haven't seen any guidance come out to tell us which way to go.
Great. Thank you. Complicated topic.
Yes, for sure.
Wondered, when you're thinking about transitioning from opioids to buprenorphine, are you often using a low dose start? And do you have any particular references or protocols that you recommend?
We do have some protocols, so I can send to like Stephanie and Laura to get to all of you. We start very low. We usually start like, we do microdosing now, so like 2 milligrams once or twice a day. We are trying to not get buprenorphine above about 12 a day. We're finding this is just anecdotal data, what we're seeing, that people do well better on buprenorphine, just like regular opiates, at a lower dose than a higher dose. So we're trying to keep the doses no more than like 12, 14 a day. We're usually starting about 2 milligrams a day and just going really, really slow. We are seeing less side effect at lower buprenorphine, although we never really had a lot of buprenorphine side effects even at higher doses. But we go slow. And I will say buprenorphine is a harder drug to get on, it seems to be, but once they're on it, it seems more stable than other opiates, but harder to get it started. It's a hard one to start.
Yeah. Great. And we'll be sure to try to share those resources. All right, I'll squeeze in one last question before the top of the hour. At the end of your talk, you were referencing some denervation procedures and wondered if those tend to be widely available in the community as you refer to pain specialists, or whether those types of procedures are challenging to access.
No, they're widely available now. The cool leaf therapy is a little harder to find. Some of your bigger pain centers will have that, but standard denervation should be pretty much in all the private practices now. It's pretty common. So I would definitely, you know, it's great for older patients that can't take a lot of medications. So we're doing a lot of them. I think I have we're doing like 12 or 15 a week per provider now for our elderly patient for like low back pain, knee pain, especially if they can't have a knee replacement or they don't want a knee replacement. The other thing, I'm just to go back real quickly, one question, I know we have to stop, but we are now, because we're microdosing buprenorphine, we are not taking them all the way off their opiate agonist before we start it. So I'm getting them down to like one or two oxycodone fives a day, or one or two, 5 or 10 Vicodins, and then start that buprenorphine and then wean the rest. So because you're doing low dose buprenorphine, you don't have to be all the way off your opiate agonist.
Right. Thank you for that clarification. I think we're becoming more familiar with avoiding the need to go into opioid withdrawal without microdosing or low-dose start. So thank you.
You're welcome. And there was a study that said, I can't remember who did it, but it was a pretty good study that said if you do take them all the way off their opiates like we used to and then start buprenorphine, you won't get as many people that are willing to try it. And I kind of don't blame them because they're scared of that withdrawal. But if you just say we can transition and just wean down and then start your new medication, it's much more user-friendly for your patient and less scary.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Maurer, thank you so much for your expertise and your generosity in teaching. Thanks to our audience, and we'll be sure to send along resources.
Yes, thank you all for having me, and enjoy the last of our sunshine, I think, before we get a little more rain.
Thanks.
Bye.